So did everyone do their homework?
Yes, Rob, of course we did our homework.
Yes, Sandy, I know that you did your homework.
I didn't.
Okay, if you were really serious students, I'll tell you what you would have done. You would have read this poem 4 or 5 times during the last week. If you were a really serious student. Because what one of the points that I hope will slowly penetrate everyone's understanding is that it's necessary to dwell upon these poems and to listen to them very uninterpretively, unmentally, non-mentally. Last time we could see clearly that there were many levels of interpretation, and the whole idea that we can hear this poem silently is problematic, because when you hear it silently, you hear it in the context of your mental framework. And I do it, and everyone does it. And although there is an interpretation of mantra that is valid with respect to inner hearing, that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is something that Sri Aurobindo did very deliberately, for a reason. And he wrote a book about the absolute necessity of sound in order to hear the meaning of this new poetry that applies the principles of mantra to poetics. And he says all the time, it's new, and he says all the time, only the ear can hear it. He doesn't say the inner ear, or the inner hearing, or the silent hearing. In that essay he says 20 times, only the ear can discriminate and catch the meaning. So that's a theory. That's a theory of poetics. But we will have ample opportunity to experience what he means, because it's not just a theory. He practiced it. So I will go back to the text at some point to mainly reinforce that idea from the text. And every time so far that we've met, I've covered text which basically says that. So the only way to really appreciate it, that theory, as I also said before, is to read the poems. So we've just begun that process. We've read a little bit only. This poem, even if you had read it just silently and mentally 3 or 4 times, you would have a concept, the concept that he's speaking about. And you would know that he has spoken about this concept in 100 different ways in his other books. This concept that he is speaking about is extremely well known through his writings. So why does he bother to write a little poem about this concept, which he has explained so thoroughly in all of his major works? he says in the essay which goes with these poems, these experimental poems, he tells us why. He says this is new transformational mantric poetry which conveys directly to the hearing the meaning. So it stops being theoretical and philosophical and a teaching in the conventional sense. And he takes on this role of transmitting from the infinite hearing the sound which changes us, which changes the vibrational structure of the disciple. So I invite you henceforth to begin to experiment with this potential. We've learned a little bit about the mechanics of it. We've heard a little bit about the importance that Sri Aurobindo has given to it and what he expects it to accomplish. But the only way to really benefit from it and really understand it is to practice it. His poems were not written for the literary review, and they were not written for mass circulation. And it's extraordinary. And what we're here, the reason why we're here in this continuum of exposure is to discover something which is not well known. It's quite extraordinary. So we will come closer and closer to appreciating that, I'm sure. Our aim is to enter into a process of exposure to qualities of understanding that are not mental.
From the used poems and then the sonnets or in the 30s that it started or the later poems, or it was always there.
It was always there.
Yeah. So you find that quality and that experimenting with it, you can find it. It doesn't matter.
Actually, Ahana was written early.
Yeah.
But it was continually worked on and the same principles were applied there that were applied later in Ilium. So when you learn how to read Sri Aurobindo's poetry and then you read Savitri, or you read the long early poems, or you read the sonnets which are in between, what you can see is a change in his focus. You can see that his own consciousness is choosing slightly different levels of material for poetic expression. But the art, the principle, was always there. So it was a gift that he had, that he discovered. And that's why it's very difficult to critique Sri Aurobindo's poetry in the context of periods of poetry. But there are some periods of poetry that, he fits nicely into. His early poems fit nicely into the 18th century, 19th century romantics. So I'll read some Shelley at some point, which will sound like Sri Aurobindo. Shelley also had this gift. Anyway, because you're not going to be here throughout the whole time, I think it's more a question of what kind of energy and experience is most relevant in one's development. You know, you may dwell upon the sonnets for months. You may dwell upon a canto of Savitri for years. Once you see and hear what's being done, then it becomes something, an entity. You know? And there are some of the most beautiful poems are some of the earlier ones, just from the music, you know. And in Khaled of the Sea, you find the same themes that you find in Savitri, but they're dealt with much more lightly and lyrically. But in that poem, he also weds a goddess and builds an empire. You know, he goes into the desert and he ends up with an empire. So what I would like to do right now is help you with your homework, because another thing that you could have done, we have a marker. And that I recommend that you do, even though it doesn't get you where you want to be, it's useful, I think, as an exercise from time to time to actually go through a poem line by line, read it three or four times, and note the metrics. The metric structure, and you'll run into things which are difficult. You won't be able to figure it out, and then you read it a few more times, and it starts to shift, and then finally you find the groove, and then you say, "Of course, it's that." And so this is just a demonstration of the fact that the truth of the poem, with respect to neither the structure nor the meaning, appears immediately in the consciousness, even if there is a very subtle receptivity. Because the weight, the sound weight, is the thing that Sri Aurobindo is using. It's his tool. And it's a tool that he uses to change the vibrational structure of the being. And so there's a shift. You know, you can feel the presence. That's just one level. But there are other levels, and ultimately you can pass into the absolute identity with what he is seeing. That's the outcome that he wants. He doesn't want us to get the idea. Everybody can get the idea. You know?
But in this context, how do you see Nirodhvarana's living in Savitri? Because he was Nirodhvarana living in Savitri. That's also important. How do you see this in context? Because Amita Mina, in her talk, she also said that the first thing was Nirodhvarana
taught her to learn something, you have to learn the rules. Yes.
No comment.
if I
could do it, well, I can't do it with the teacher. If I could do it, I would make some more space in between each line so that we could mark the lines. Because that's what I would like to do first. I would like for us to analyze this poem for its metric structure. But while doing it, I want us to hear the metric structure. I don't think that you're going to be able to do it, or that I would be able to do it, without hearing it. I tried, and I couldn't. But the more I read it, the more clear it became. And also everything else became clearer. So I would like a volunteer to read and tell me where to mark, or mark yourself, a couple of lines. And as you notice, there's an enjambment here, that all the lines wrap around. So we won't break that pattern. You can read it up to here, or you can read it up to here, or you can read it until you get to the end of the sentence. This sentence. Okay, there's a sentence there. So would somebody like to volunteer to take a shot at just reading the line, maybe reading it twice, think about it a little bit, and then tell us what kind of feet we have here, what kind of meters and quantities we have. Oh, first of all, I'd like everyone to stand up and just loosen up a little bit. Loosen up, just shake. See if you can be loose. Okay, then I would like you to make a sound. Let's make a chest sound. Quite openly, an ah. Until you hear your chest and vocal cords vibrating. Ah.
Comrade of man who sits august.
Okay, how do we mark that?
Who art thou?
Who art thou in the heart? Thou and heart. I'm not sure about the who.
Who art thou?
In the heart.
In the heart.
Who art thou in the heart, comrade?
In the heart. Yes. Why is in long?
Who art thou in the heart?
Who art thou
in the heart?
In the heart.
Comrade.
Comrade of man.
That's what our video is doing. So now read it again and think about the up to where you've gotten.
Who art thou in the heart? Comrade of man.
What was it? Comrade of man? Comrade of man.
Comrade.
Not comrade of man.
Yeah.
What was it? Comrade of man. Comrade. Comrade of man.
Comrade.
And then in between you put these divisions of feet that we see where feet are ending.
No, but this is these are feet. You know that iambic.
No, wait a minute. There are the three steps feet. So you put in between that we can see feet and. Or you go on two steps feet.
I don't think it's necessary to mark the feet, because we know that a foot is either two or three syllables. It cannot be more or less. So. This would be, if this is correct, then this is the first foot. Who art thou?
So this is majestic.
That's what it would be, yeah. So you think that it's who art thou in the heart, comrade of man, who sits august. Read it like that, more or less.
Who art thou in the heart, comrade of man, who sits august.
In August, why?
August only the first.
It's another line. August.
It's an enjambment. The line doesn't stop until you get to the to August.
Yeah, but
isn't
it?
No, the meaning, yes.
Yeah. So we're doing meaning and quantity. So I said in the beginning, it's best to go ahead and wrap it around, because it belongs together. If you stop here, then you would want to stop with who sits. It's not the end. Okay, does anybody have a different reading? Yes.
Well, I would just put more emphasis on the who.
Yeah, me too.
Go ahead.
Who art thou in the heart, comrade of man, who sits august? You want me to go?
Okay, so what would I change here?
Make who more. Can it be an in-between of the accent and the accent?
How about that?
I can do that.
This is a spandi. And it's a main principle in this. This is the verse form which is used here is Ionic. And they are hexameters. They're Ionic hexameters. That means they come from the Homeric. This is a Homeric structure. And Sri Aurobindo says that there are a couple of patterns that are used here. There are two koryams between an initial spandi and a final iamb. So two koryams means long, short, short, long. That's a koryam. And this is a spandi. Who art thou? It's a very interrogative. The question is stronger than the thou. Who art thou? So they have equal weight.
Comrade also.
And where is it? It's in the heart. Who art thou in the heart? Comrade of man. And this is an interrogative structure. This is the question. Who art thou in the heart, comrade of man? Thou and comrade of man are appositive. It's an appositive structure. If you're asking a question of someone, who art thou, comrade of man?
In the chair.
Sitting in the chair. Sneaking into my room. Thief? Who art thou? Sneaking into my room. Thief? Who art thou in the heart, comrade of man? Because he is our friend. Whoever he is our friend. And he's being addressed. Who art thou in the heart, comrade of man, who sittest august? Now, let's mark the quantity, the weight lengths. Srimoy, where do you think the weight goes in this line? The weight means the whole weight of the voice, which is carrying the rhythm. Because it's not comrade of man who sits. You can't read it like that kind of accentual poetry. It's not like that. Comrade of man is a block of weighted sound, for example. So if you were going to read this poem with full meaning, why don't you try that? And then listen to where the weight really falls.
Who art thou in the heart, comrade of man, who sits august?
So this is the quantitative meter. There are four quantitative feet, and there are six hexametric feet. It's a hexameter, and it has a quantitative structure on top of the stress structure. You agree?
Yes.
Second line?
It will be the same. I was the same question. Now you have four weights, but is there a main weight? Or it comes in
first? No, each of those is pretty equal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important.
The next line is the same structure. So
would you like to read it?
But if you even read it, spoil it.
Go ahead.
But August has to be there in the line.
Please, just start with watching and read it.
I can't watch. August. Because it's a link between.
Okay, read August first then.
August, watching his works. Watching his joys and griefs. The same, absolutely.
Next word?
The same.
No, just read the word.
Unmoved.
Unmoved. Unmoved. Unmoved.
try this. Who art thou in the heart, comrade of man, who sitst august, watching his works, watching his joys and griefs, unmoved?
But this is against me.
Rob, in the second line, in the second, well, it's the third foot in.
Yeah, opposite.
If you have his works,
works
to be his works.
What? No, one this part. His
works.
Watching
his works.
Yes.
His works. Watching his joys. Okay. So then, what is this called?
It's the same as.
It's called a choriam.
Okay. So there are two choriams, and there's a spondee and an ion. That's the main pattern. There are variations.
I was going to say, he allows for variations. He even tells you about them.
He allows for variations, and he does tell you about them, and there's a very interesting one there called Ionic A minore, and there's also Ionic A maggiore, which he also uses in this poem, which is quite interesting to me. Anyway, so, who sits august, watching his works, watching his joys and griefs, unmoved. Who goes next? Want to try?
Careless of pain, careless of death and fate.
One more time. It's the end of the sentence.
Yes.
Unmoved. Careless of pain. Careless of death and fate.
Okay. Would you like to read the whole three lines once?
Who art thou in the heart, comrade of man, who sits august, watching his works, watching his joys and griefs, unmoved. Careless of pain, careless of death and fate.
Okay. Question? What do we do with careless?
Careless.
You think it's careless?
Yeah, it's in my world.
What about man faith?
And faith.
She read it. She read it like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. How did you read it,
Rob? I read it a little bit differently. But it's fine like that. All right, let's take on the next sentence. Another question.
Witness, what hast thou seen, watching this great blind world, moving helpless in time, world on the wheel in space? That yet thou, with thy vast will, biddest toil our hearts, mystic. Oh, I should do everything from mystic.
Yeah, I think you can stop with biddest toil our hearts. Okay, that was good. Does anybody observe anything important?
Blind world, there's two emphases in the poem. Yes. And she read it. Pray, blind world.
Yes. Blind world. Witness. That's comrade of man. Witness. Maybe a little inflection. Witness, like you. What hast thou seen? Watching this great blind world, moving, helpless in time. You think helpless is a...
Helpless can be like careless.
Yes.
Now, what do we do with this one?
World, wheel, and space. World, wheel, and space.
Like that? Yeah, that's how I do this.
A question about that witness line. What hast thou seen? I kind of have a hard time not reading them with equal weight. What hast thou seen?
Yeah, it's very subtle. Witness, what hast thou seen? What hast thou seen? What hast seems to have pretty equal weight.
But so is thou and seen. I mean, out of those four, I put the most weight on seen, but I don't think what hast thou has lesser weight to the point that it's unaccented.
But listen to it. Listen to the whole thing together. What hast thou seen? There's a slight drop in emphasis on hast thou. What hast thou seen?
But not as much of a drop as
came. Not as much.
That's
right.
So that's why I questioned that.
Witness, what hast thou seen? Watching this great blind world, moving helpless in time, world on the wheel in space, that yet thou with thy vast will biddest toil our hearts. That yet...
So one question on sorry, but thou is like one syllable.
Biddest most probably doesn't have it in story, the whole world. Biddest.
That yet thou with thy vast will biddest toil.
Biddest toil.
Is it a dactyl?
Otherwise it's
vast will. And we could follow here the same pattern and have this be a choriam.
Yes.
Biddest
toil. Yeah.
This can be that yet thou with thy vast will biddest.
Yeah, that's my emphasis.
This can be this is, this would be a quarter hand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then it would be like that one and like that one, yes, and like that one. Is that how you marked it?
No, I marked it as long. So that the foot there with four da 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 would be widow, vidis, troil.
Okay, I see what you mean, but listen to it like this. That yet thou with thy vast will biddest toil our hearts. Now, for me there's a big break in meaning here. This seems to be a completely different idea to me. Somebody could start reading it from here and include this line now and see where it goes in terms of voice, weight and inflection and meaning. Somebody want to volunteer to read those four lines?
Witness.
Start with witness and include this line this time. But be aware that there's a major shift in meaning here. Somebody try?
Witness. What hast thou seen, watching this great blind world moving, helpless in time? World on the wheel in space, that yet thou with thy vast will biddest toil our hearts. Mystic, for without thee nothing can last in time. I don't understand the interrogation mark.
Okay. It begins with, what hast thou seen?
Okay.
And so there is no inflection at the end. The question was completed earlier. Witness, what hast thou seen, watching this great blind world, moving helpless in time, world on the wheel in space, that yet thou with thy vast will biddest toil our hearts. Mystic, for without thee nothing can last in time. Mystic, for without thee nothing can last in time. So there's a meaning now is given to this witness. That not only is he a witness, but everything which happens depends completely on him. So the question is, who can summarize the question?
What is the motivation to let us toil?
What have you seen that makes it worthwhile for you to uphold this? You must have seen something that I don't see. Okay, now in this poem, Sri Aurobindo moves in the direction of the teaching which we had earlier from the Katha Upanishad. we too, when from the urge ceaseless of nature turn our souls, far from the breast casting her tool, desire, grow like thee. In the front, nature still drives in vain the blind trail of our acts, passions and thoughts and hopes. Unmoved, calm, we look on, careless of death and fate, of grief careless, and joys, signs of a surface script without value or sense, steps of an aimless world. Now it's we.
Him, watching this.
Yes, we become like him, and we too see this, careless of everything that happens.
Unmoved, careless.
But who is it? Something watches behind. Spirit or self or soul. Viewing space and its toil. What waiting the end of time. Witness, who then art thou? One with thee, who am I? Nameless, watching the wheel whirl across time and space. Yeah. So what's different about it?
It would be sounding differently, like nameless, watching the wheel whirl across time and space.
Yeah. This one, across time and space.
Across is unexpected.
This becomes what Sri Aurobindo calls the ionic. Majore. Nameless, watching the wheel, so that one is the same as usual, Koryam, watching the wheel
whirl across time and space. That makes sense.
It's still whirl across time and space. That's still the same structure, isn't it?
Well, I think it fits into the same structure, but I think whole poem, when you get to that line, a cross doesn't drop like that.
No, but that's, isn't that the weight though? That's not the foot. That's the weight length.
I think the poem gains momentum, and at the end it has more strong.
So how would you indicate that?
A cross is different.
World cross time. I would really only unaccent up.
Are those the four quantitative feet? I think so. So that's a very good example of how the weight length takes over from the metric length.
But it's the same. It's absolutely the same as the first line. Well, I'm kind of
Yeah, it is the same as the first line. Well, no, it's not the same, because here we have who art thou in the heart. Here we have nameless watching the wheel.
But the second line...
No, it's a big difference.
Now just wait a minute. You see August every second line, third line, fourth line.
I would say this is a very important, huge difference between the first line and the last line.
No, the second line and the same as this line, don't you?
Yeah.
See, but... No, it occurs in other places, but it's not, the weight distribution is not always the same.
In the... Row like V is like the first line also. Whereas the weight is on the first three instead of the first two, and then the
Which line is it you're talking about?
Row like the, it's like right in the middle. Down there. You couldn't put the weight on row like the in the front, because there's a period in there.
Our souls far from the breast, casting their tool desire, grow like thee. In the front, nature still drives in vain.
In the last line, if you separate the wheel from wheel and across time and space.
So how do we scan this in terms of accent?
Like is short. Nature still and drives are all along. You can't swallow still. Nature still drives.
Well, the in nature, that was it.
Short.
In nature, still
dry. Is not short, but I would not read it short.
In the front?
No, still. The word still is not a, it's not a skipped over word.
It's only much shorter than the dry.
I think there should be a in the middle of accented, unaccented, and accented less than the accented, but not unaccented.
Okay, let's read it again. We too, when from the urge ceaseless of nature, turn our souls far from the breast, casting her tool, desire, grow like thee. In the front, nature still drives.
Still drives.
In the front, nature still drives in vain. The blind trail of our acts. Okay, that's good.
discussion still, for instance, as an example, because it's short, but it has a stress, and thrives has a stress in this long, so naturally it has more weight.
Now, what in that line, in the front, nature still drives in vain. That phrase merits
a lot of long stress.
A very distinct emphasis. And that's when, if Don were here, we could say a pause is appropriate. But the pause is very subtle. And the emphasis which follows the pause is very strong. If you really want to capture the subtle nuance of meaning there. And so then there's an interesting thing that I wanted to show you that from the critical text. Page 347. In this passage, he is referring on the previous page to how he says, even if the new forms are only an improvement on stress meter, only an improvement on stress meter, a rhythm starting from the same swing of the language, that is no objection. If the stress meter, like we've marked it, is... Oh, we can't see it, huh?
We can go through the prose and see where it goes away.
Yeah, we can do that. So, that's what he says on the previous page, you know, even if the stress meter is the basic thing, and the quantity is only an improvement on the stress, that's still an improvement on the traditional principles. And then on this page, he says, a free use of modulation. This in vain that I was speaking about is a modulation of the voice. A free use of modulation, an avoidance of metrical rigidity by other devices natural to the flexibility of the English tongue, a skillful employment of overlapping enjambment, which this poem embodies on every line almost, of caesura, of word grouping, are presupposed in any reasonable quantitative system. So that means it does not follow a regular stress pattern. But the regular stress pattern is there underlying.
Well, it means it follows the regular stress pattern.
Not at all.
Changing itself and flowing as it should flow according to the stress pattern.
According to speech.
According to the meter.
No, not according to the meter at all. This is the last line that we underlined, and the first line that we underlined were not according to the meter.
But both statements of this kind are equally right, because the compromise is in between the two.
Okay, now listen to the next sentence. Even where a very regular movement is necessitated or desirable, the resources of the play of sound, a subtle play of vowelation and of consonant harmonies, rhythmic undertones and overtones, ought to cure the alleged deficiency. So we could see in these lines that if we just followed the strict stress meters and accent meters, we would not have gotten the full value of the line. It was those longer combinations of meters, those four groupings of sound, which overrode those seven groupings of sound very consistently.
This happens to every poetry, not only...
No, it's in every language like that.
I find it difficult because of my English to do this. It's not so natural for me.
Right.
How is it?
So that in itself is natural.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when you speak, it's natural. When you say it, it's natural.
Yeah.
But not for me that way. You have to say it.
Yeah. So this reading this kind of poetry can help you actually in your use of English and in developing a subtler appreciation of meanings. So if you read it, don't apply your mind though. Try to read it aloud and listen to it. And then if it somehow didn't quite mean anything or sound right, then read it again and listen to it. And then little by little the rhythm will lead you into, you know, that moment when you catch it.
I got that from this. I see that.
So there are all of these layers. You know, when I read it, I see the first time I read it, the second time, the third time, the fourth time. Finally, the fifth or sixth time, I think I'm getting it. You know, I'm getting the understanding and also I'm getting the correct expression at the same, you know, in the same movement.
I find this very encouraging, actually, teaching English.
Yeah, so when you apply this tool, this art of reading to Savitri, suddenly the depth of meaning starts, it's expanding and expanding and expanding. And there are six-line passages, for example, which are a continuum. And you absolutely cannot understand the first two lines until you get to the sixth line. And then it's only in this, like a symphony, it's in this sound dimension where the image resonates with its culmination. Now there's another poem, I'd like to just read through it. Since we have 10 minutes left. There's a poem in this same group that deals with the same idea exactly, but in a much different way. On page 383, let's see, where am I here? 379, 80, 81, 82, it should be the next one, right? 82, 83. I am going to reduce it so we can get more of it on the page. Is that too small?
Yeah.
Well, that's the whole page. Is that all right? Into the silence, into the silence arise, O Spirit immortal, away from the turning wheel, breaking the magical circle. Ascend, single and deathless, care no more for the whispers and the shoutings in the darkness. Pass from the sphere of the gray and the little, leaving the cry and the struggle into the silence forever. Vast and immobile, formless and marvelous, higher than heaven, wider than the universe, in a pure glory of being, in a bright stillness of self-seeing, communing with a boundlessness voiceless and intimate. Make thy knowledge too high for thought, thy joy too deep for emotion. At rest in the unchanging light, mute with the wordless self-vision, Spirit, pass out of thyself. Soul, escape from the clutch of nature. All thou hast seen, cast from thee, O witness. Turn to the alone and the absolute. Turn to the eternal. Be only eternity. Peace and silence. O world transcending, nameless oneness, Spirit immortal. At rest in the unchanging light, mute with the wordless self-vision, Spirit, pass out of thyself. Soul, escape from the clutch of nature. All thou hast seen, cast from thee, O witness. Turn to the alone and the absolute. Turn to the eternal. the only eternity, peace and silence. O world transcending, nameless oneness, spirit immortal. I think reading those two poems, The Witness and the Wheel and this one, The Ascent, and there's a second part of The Ascent on the next page. Just working with those three poems for a while can be rewarding. Wait till you read part two of The Ascent. You'll get a pleasant surprise. And this is the enigma of the Katupanishad also. Good question.
Ah!